Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day. Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Knife. This is Patrick Georgioff. I want you to imagine this. It's 2 a.m. and you're rushing a hypotensive trauma patient to the operating room for exploration. Maybe you need to go into the neck, the chest, or the abdomen. Are you prepared for what you might find? Trauma educational resources are extremely limited, and that's why we created the Trauma Surgery Video Atlas. 24 challenging scenarios with high-yield text, beautiful illustrations, and stunning professional-grade video that walks you through the approach and management of devastating injuries in a step-by-step fashion. Check out the link in the show notes for more. There are group discounts available as well. Now, enjoy the episode and dominate the day.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife with the Emergency General Surgery Team in Tiger Country here at Mizzou. I'm Dr. Devin. Today we're going to be tackling one of the most lethal and sometimes frustrating disease processes we manage as acute care surgeons, fulminant Clostridium difficile infection. This is not just a medical disease. It's a surgical disease with a narrow window where timing, judgment, and experience determines survival. So with that, let's meet the team.
Hey, I'm Kevin Barso. I'm a general surgeon here at Mizzou.
Hi, I'm Raymond Okeke. I'm the SCCM ACS fellow.
My name's Dezra Fletcher. I'm a third-year general surgery resident here.
And I'm Jeff Kokenauer, one of the acute care surgery faculty and trauma medical director.
Awesome. Dezra, so let's level set for our listeners. The CDC and the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons defines Clostridium difficile as diarrhea, which is classically more than 3 watery stools per day, with positive C. diff toxin testing. But the clinical important distinction for our surgeons is severity.
Yep, that's correct. So a mild disease is typically a white count less than 15,000 and creatinine less than 1.5, whereas severe disease is the opposite, greater than 15,000 white count and creatinine greater than 1.5. So fulminant disease is defined by hypotension, sepsis, shock, ileus, megacolon, or ICU level sickness. The mortality for fulminant disease can exceed 50%, especially once organ failure develops.
Yeah, and that's key. Fulminant Clostridium difficile is not simply just bad diarrhea. It's systemic disease. It's colitis plus end organ malperfusion. In other words, it's essentially shock, right? Without the septic shock. Raymond.
Right. So risk factors here include recent antibiotic exposure, especially clindamycin, fluoroquinolones, cephalosporins, beta-lactamase inhibitors, plus advanced age, immunosuppression, IBD, diabetes, CHF, tube feeds, PPI exposure, and recent hospitalization or GI surgery.
Yeah, that's quite a bit. Why don't you give us some contemporary diagnostic framework?
Right. The big concept here is diagnostic stewardship. So testing should generally be limited to patients who had new unexplained diarrhea, so at least 3 watery stools in 24 hours. And unless you're worried about fulminant disease with ileus or megacolon or unexplained leukocytosis, the most important thing here is to not test warm stool.
Great. So how do we test this? So testing is either with NAAT or PCR testing, as we formally send, or you can actually do a two-step method, which can help distinguish between silent carriers, asymptomatic, and then symptomatic CDA. The two-step process typically involves a toxin assay, the glutamate dehydrogenase, plus the NAAT, but no test perfectly separates colonization from the true infection.
Yeah. So where does imaging fall in all this, Raymond?
Right. So your CT scan will show colonic wall thickening. It will show pancolitis, thumbprinting, ascites, ileus, or toxic megacolon. It's important, though, to note that a normal or nonspecific CT does not rule out clinically important disease, as this is, again, largely a mucosal-based disease.
Right. Exactly. I think that's a big take-home point. CT can support the diagnosis, but it doesn't decide the operation. So with that, let's anchor all this with the ASPAR treatment recommendations.
Yeah, absolutely. So for non-fulminant CDA, oral vanc or fidoxamicin are first-line therapies. Metronidazole, Flagyl, is no longer preferred as first-line therapy for most patients. This is because it's been shown to have lower cure rates and higher recurrence when compared to vancomycin.
Exactly. For fulminant CDI, ASCARS recommends vancomycin, so 500 milligrams PO or enteral 4 times a day, or Flagyl 500 milligrams, and that's IV every 8 hours. You can add rectal vancomycin if there's ileus present. So again, important to stop or narrow the inciting antibiotics when possible. Resuscitate with fluids and replace electrolytes. Avoid anti-motility agents and then consult surgery early.
Exactly. The last part is probably most key for our audience. Early surgical consultation is not failure of medical management, but it's really the safe and correct management. So with that, let's take a quick pivot and try to get to the literature a little bit. And let's highlight some of the key EGS papers, as well as the actual guidance from the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons.
Yep. So from the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons, early surgical consultation in fulminant C. diff is a strong recommendation. Indications for operative intervention are refractory shock, so greater than 12 to 24 hours, a rising lactate trends, typically greater than 5, leukocytosis greater than 50,000, and organ failure. The key bottom line with this is that delay equals mortality. Basically, waiting until multi-organ failure is established worsens post-op mortality.
Right. Meta-analyses here have shown that subtotal colectomy actually reduces mortality compared to continued medical therapy in severe disease. Again, outcomes, however, remain poor overall with about a 30 to 50 percent mortality.
Yeah, so with that, why don't we transition a bit? So what about the big debate in C. diff?
Yep, so kind of two arms, subtotal colectomy versus the loop ileostomy and lavage. Subtotal colectomy remains the gold standard and for source control. Loop ileostomy plus the antegrade vancomycin lavage is less invasive. However, there's highly mixed data on mortality benefit.
Yeah. So contemporary literature essentially suggests that ileostomy approach may work in select and less sick patients, but in true fulminant shock, I think the answer will always safely be colectomy remains the gold standard. But why don't we just unpack that a little bit and work a clinical MD to bring our two senior surgeons on board. It's a 47-year-old female. She has a history of decompensated cirrhosis. She's got a MELD of 26 with a history of chronic atrial fibrillation, heart failure with moderately reduced ejection fraction around 40 to 45%, and type 2 diabetes. She just got back from a trip from Barcelona, and she's been having about 3 days of profuse watery diarrhea, cramping, abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. In the ER, her vitals were 90s over 60s, a heart rate of 120, temperature of 37.9, white count of 20, creatinine of 1.8, bicarb of 18, and an INR of 2.3. She had initial stool studies that were done in the ED that actually showed no C. diff, but enteropathogenic E. coli was positive, and at that point she was started on Cipro and admitted to the medicine ward. She started to look better just for a hot minute, though. About 5 days later, if we fast forward, she had an abrupt change on the floor where she became febrile, hypotensive with MAPS less than 50, altered mental status, and persistent diarrhea. At the time, her white count was found to be 45, with a lactate of 4.5, creatinine of 2.8, an INR of 3.2, and platelet count of 80. Essentially, she was diagnosed to be in septic shock. And in all rapid manner, she was transferred to the medical ICU and started on goal-directed sepsis medical therapy with pressors and fluids. And she had a repeat PCR that was completed and positive now for C. diff. In the medical ICU, she got escalated appropriately with medications. She was started on PO vancomycin and IV metronidazole. But during this time, she continued to spiral and was intubated for persistent hypoxia. And following goal-directed fluid resuscitation, her acidosis started to level off and her vasopressor requirements started to slowly reduce. During this time, the medical intensivist obtained a CT scan and it showed diffuse colitis, primarily on the left side, without any evidence of megacolon or perforation. She did have massive third spacing, lots of ascites, edema, and anasarca. At this point, finally, acute care surgery was consulted and we're at the bedside. So let's take a quick pause here. You're the faculty. You've been told that there's no perforation, no megacolon. She's overall becoming a little bit more stable on vasopressors and acid and showing subtle signs of improvement in bicarb and lactate. So the question to our panel and our senior surgeons is, would you operate right now? Or would you keep pushing medical therapy? Is there something you would tell the medical intensivists that they haven't completed or should entertain?
So I think for me, looking at this overall picture, is you have a very medically complex patient with probably a surgical problem. I would say she has improved on most of your medical therapy. Nothing has significantly worsened over the last little bit of time. So at this point, I'd probably keep closely monitoring this patient. And if anything clinically changes, it would push me to go to the operating room. Again, no hard signs on CT scan, but at this point, again, we're treating the human and not the CT scan.
Yeah. Would you guys at this point consider maybe even adding rectal enemas, like Venk enemas?
I think it's not harmful. It might be helpful.
Yeah. Well, she got that. They started the rectal enemas and waited about another 24 hours. About the next day, though, her lactate was still hanging around 2 to 3.5, and her pH was still acidotic, metabolic primarily, 7.28. However, later that afternoon, she started developing guarding, a little bit more and localized peritonitis in the pelvis and right and left lower abdomen. You guys know the answer. At this point, she was taken to the operating room under our service, and we did perform a subtotal colectomy, which she did have a favorable outcome, which I'll talk about here shortly towards the end. But I want this to be kind of a transition point for us to talk about when to operate and the salient steps of the operations that we need to do. The American Society of Colorectal Surgery states that surgery should typically be reserved for perforation or severe colitis that fails to improve with medical therapy. But the problem with all recommendations and even textbooks is that there's just no clear black and white algorithm. We should probably talk, it's more gray area, and we should probably talk more about the physiology and kind of what triggers us as surgeons at the bedside to intervene early or wait. So, Dr. Kochenhauer, what are your triggers?
Primarily the word kiddo and dart when it comes to thoracic decompression.
That's great.
Okay.
That's great. Let's come back to EGS, sir.
So, it is a difficult question to answer. I think most patients are going to deserve at least 24 to 48-ish hours of medical therapy, and you're going to see how they respond. I think more important than any single collection of data points are going to be the patient's data points over time, right? What's the trend? Any patient that exhibits persistent or worsened acidosis or organ dysfunction, certainly more likely to move towards operation. Mm-hmm. I think exam, although it's part of the equation, every one of these patients, it's difficult. It's limited. They're often already sedated. They're mechanically ventilated. Can you gauge worsened distension, volume, overload? Anytime I think that there's a concern for intra-abdominal hypertension in addition to the abnormal physiology, then we're probably headed to the operator.
So I think the teachable point is, you don't have to operate on everyone early, but it's important to identify the patient who is crossing the line from severe C. diff to that medically refractory fulminant C. diff that's just festering before they become unsalvageable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So again, I think timing is everything. You're looking at both physiology and exam, and that exam can be difficult. So in this case, again, this is an ill patient, had a white count of 45, lactate of 4.5, had some press requirement. And the question is, should that have been enough? Or did the team do the right thing and wait to have peritoneal signs? And then another question is, did this patient with cirrhosis, did it cloud judgment or change the urgency and approach? Again, MELD was 26, INR 3.2, and platelet count of 80. This is a patient who may not survive surgery, but also this patient definitely won't survive without it. So the question becomes, does cirrhosis push you toward number one, earlier surgery, or number two, a delayed surgery?
Yeah, I think listening to Kochenhauer talk and honestly, listening to this patient and being involved in her care, my humble opinion is, will you wait before she becomes unsalvageable? And being less conservative and going to the OR early is probably the best bet. Again, for this case, a subtotal colectomy with endileostomy was performed, which is what the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons does recommend for severe, complicated, or fulminant Clostridium difficile. And as we go through that, and as a patient is in extremis and peritonitic, and maybe we have waited a little too long, unfortunately, on this case, we're now speed walking ourselves to the operating room. And in Dr. Kokenauer and Dr. Arto, I really would like us to have you guys walk us through the way that you handle the operation. What do you do? What do you tell the residents and the fellows, or young surgeons like myself, how to safely perform this operation in an expedited manner to get them through to resuscitation and continue their medical therapy?
So for me, this is not a time to be cute. So it's going to be a midline laparotomy. This is a source control operation. We're not here to make a fancy ostomy or some fancy oncologic resection. So the goal is to safely remove the diseased colon, limit your operative time, try to avoid as much bleeding as you can, and get the patient back to the ICU.
How much colon are you taking out?
I'm taking out everything I can get my hands on. Quick mobilization, getting both the right and the left freed, and then often using some sort of an energy device to just quickly move from wherever we've elected to divide terminal ileum, and then just motoring our way around. Most of the mesentery you're going to leave behind. Again, as Dr. Bartow just said, this is not an oncologic resection, so you're usually able to stay up towards the colon, but it's probably one of the most, take the training wheels off maybe, case where you have to, every move has got to be with a purpose, so that you can get this operation done in a timely manner.
And I think another key here is sometimes the colon can fool you. Again, this is a mucosal disease, and sometimes I've seen you look inside and some of the colon looks pretty normal. But I agree with Jeff that a subtotal colectomy is what is needed. And according to the Askar's point, again, gross appearance can underestimate disease. Again, this is a mucosal-based disease. And then in some patients who did not receive the subtotal colectomy, reoperation for additional resection has been reported with a very high mortality. So I agree. I think we try to take as much as you can get out in a most efficient manner.
As a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, I can tell you, getting involved made all the difference in my career.
Yeah, Jason, same here. The connections alone have stayed with me throughout my career thus far.
Whether you're exploring a path in surgery, in training, or well into practice, the American College of Surgeons supports you at every stage. That means mentorship from practicing surgeons, opportunities to connect and lead, access to scholarships for Clinical Congress, the nation's largest gathering of surgeons, and a worldwide network invested in your success.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not just national. You can get involved locally right away.
With local chapters, specialty communities, and surgical interest groups, you don't have to wait. And you can get plugged in right now.
Yeah, it's not just about building your CV. It's about finding your place in surgery and staying connected throughout your career.
So head to facs.org to learn more or join the American College of Surgeons. And if you're a medical student or resident, use promo code BTK26 to waive your application fee. That's BTK26 to waive your American College of Surgeons application fee.
Yeah, so if I can ask you guys some like really more detailed kind of technical points in the OR. You know, it's one thing to be able to speak and say all the right things like in an oral board and in preparation. That's another thing when you're actually in the, you know, in the trenches and actually in the OR and doing the procedure. You know, I've seen enough at this point now that a lot of these patients, their colon, their tissues, they're just very friable. There's massive edema, especially in somebody like this with decompensated liver disease. Everything's hemorrhagic, kind of oozing, and there's massive ascites, and sometimes a retroperitoneal might be popping into your face with a heavy hematoma when you're doing that dissection. And then don't forget that splenic flexure, right? And how do you deal with a rectal stump? Did you guys do anything different? Like, what do you use, the same staplers every time, the same energy devices every time? Do you tackle the terminal ileum first, or do you mobilize a sigmoid and take it off the rectosigmoid junction, then go backwards? Do y'all do anything specific to expedite your operations?
So again, for me, I'm a midline laparotomy. Obviously, start with exposure and a rapid assessment. If you can get the small bowel away, I certainly do that. I start on the right side. I think it's the most consistent anatomy. And again, your goal is to take the colon out. And my typical operative plan is to give an end ileostomy. I think it's easiest to divide the terminal ileum right away and use that as a handle. I am also a very heavy stapler use. And so I tend to use a vascular load on my stapler to take most of my vascular pedicles. And it makes it really fast and a much more hemostatic operation. I'm not digging through and chopping through with an energy device. I will say the splenic flexure is tricky. Don't be afraid to extend your incision as high as you need to get all the way around the spleen or the splenic flexure, because you certainly don't want to be taken out of spleen in addition to your colon in this pretty unstable human. Jeff, you got any other tips?
I think, you know, the colon's likely going to be, it's going to be distended. It's going to be friable. You're going to have to be careful with how you handle it. But again, every movement has to be with a purpose. So you've got to not be afraid to pull it medially as you're taking down the lateral attachments. You still have to be careful as you come around hepatic flexure, for instance. Don't be so in a hurry that you pull up duodenum or make silly errors. I think if patients have big fat omentum hanging off the transverse, sometimes taking an extra 5 or 10 minutes with an energy device to get that out of your way can be helpful. But just, I've already said it several times, but just moving with a purpose and continuing to progress is really the hallmark of this successful operation.
I would also say, Dr. Debbie asked about, you know, different staplers. I would let the tissue tell you what to use. So
yeah,
across the rectum, I typically would use a thicker stapler load. Across the TI, obviously a thinner stapler load. And these are things I have planned out before I start the operation. And I tell my team, I want all the staple loads and all the colors, because I know it's not a one size fits all operation.
Yeah, this is the case where you don't want to be waiting for your scrub tech or your nurse to be going out and getting different loads because they're across the OR. The more you can communicate beforehand to have as much as you can get in the
protocols. You know the operation you're going to do, and you know the tools you're going to need. So communicate that up front, because that way nobody's running to find things.
How do you deal with your rectal stump? Do you guys staple it and then over-sew, or cut it and sew it? With the friable tissue and that thickness, just speaking from experience from this last year, I had one rectal stump blowout from a similar infection, and I've been stapling across. But, you know, I've heard multiple M&Ms and multiple other senior surgeons, some people talk about just cutting it and then over-sewing it in two layers or over-sewing their staple lines. Seems like voodoo, but do you guys do anything different?
I make sure I have the correct staple load for the thickness of the tissue, that the stump is vascularized. You haven't taken all the mesentery, you know, leave a long stump, and then I staple it and don't touch it again.
Yeah.
I think most of the time the bad fulminant disease tends to make the colon look abnormal higher up. So by the time you get that far down, usually it's not that difficult. And I think, you know, what you said, KB, that using whatever load that you normally would use across the rectum, if it's large, then, I mean, you have to be prepared for a plan B. If what you typically do is probably not going to be safe. Don't try to squeeze your usual square peg into a round hole.
Yeah, no, that's been kind of a hard learning point, trying to get out of your comfort zone and move and do what the patient needs. That kind of dovetails into this last point. This patient's cirrhotic, right? She's acidotic, she's hypothermic, she's bleeding from all of her orifices, she's on multiple pressors, you're trying to get this colon out safely and efficiently. What do you consider damage control? Like, and what are your steps for that damage control?
Yeah, so I think this is a great example of what is classically known as a trick question. We're already doing a damage control operation. We've already sort of, you know, kind of flirted with failure rescue, and depending on how abnormal their physiology is. So the one parallel I'll say, which was expertly discussed in one of our prior episodes, is when you get done doing a really difficult cholecystectomy, all the bleeding dries up, right? In this operation, when you get yourself down to almost complete the colectomy, it's amazing oftentimes how often the physiology starts to improve. So getting that diseased colon out, it may be difficult, they may be sick, but I can't remember a time where I've failed because they're ill, because the one thing that's going to make them better is finishing the operation. So you got to go, baby, go, and be mindful. You have really close communication with your anesthesia colleagues, but I don't think there's a stopping point.
I think a good principle that the TV guys are saying, and I think I'm getting from this, is don't let that perfect colectomy kill you. Don't wait and don't try to be cute. Don't try to be perfect. Be safe, be efficient, but get it out safely and get the patient back to the ICU as soon as possible to complete their resuscitation and medical care. So let's pivot just for a minute, or change gears. While we're here, let's just spend a few minutes on that most elusive topic and debate, fulminant C. diff, and the operative debate being subtotal colectomy versus diverting loop ileostomy with antegrade colonic lavage using vancomycin. When it comes to this debate, there's a really good episode, I believe it's 648 for our EGS journal review, that goes over this exact topic in a little bit more detail. It's broken down for, you know, our listeners in that episode, but I'd like to go over it in broad strokes for everybody to listen to and us to have a discussion as it pertains to this patient. So just to recap, the loop ileostomy approach really gained its traction with the Pittsburgh group in 2011. What they proved by doing that antegrade lavage with vancomycin enemas was a lower mortality compared to historical colectomy cohorts. And they touted the fact of colonic preservation and quicker time for potential reversal. However, since then, a lot of data has come out, things have changed, and clinical practices has evolved. So let's kind of hit the pro sides of the loop ileostomy first. Raymond, let's make an argument.
All right. So for the loop ileostomy, it's less of a physiologic insult than a colectomy. You can avoid a large laparotomy and a dissection, especially in patients who are unstable. You can preserve the colon, which again gives that potential quality of life benefit. And you can do an antegrade lavage and a direct intraluminal vancomycin delivery. So essentially, you are providing intraluminal treatment for an intraluminal disease. So essentially, in the right patient, you can convert a lethal disease into a recoverable one without removing the colon.
And I would say a counterpoint to that is when you look at more recent data, there's really no consistent mortality benefit across studies. I do think there was a significant selection bias. Many of those studies exclude the sickest patients, and then oftentimes a failure required a delayed colectomy, and that's not a trivial problem to have. So I don't think we're comparing apples to apples. We're comparing selected patients against the sickest patients.
Yeah. So, hey, Jeff, why don't you tell us why the gold standard is colectomy?
Because it's the right operation. The point, I think, to be underscored is that if you get away with it, then the patient potentially gets better. If they don't, they potentially die. And I would argue in our experience, more often than not, the patients didn't have a very robust response and we were going back to complete it. So colon is the problem. The colon needs to be removed.
Yep. Toxin-producing colon, get it out. It's simple. Loop ileostomy tends to treat the mucosal lumen and colectomy treats the disease, simply put. Let's make this practical. Raymond, tell us who gets what.
All right, so for a loop ileostomy, it can be a reasonable option if your patient is not in refractory shock, if they have limited vasopressor requirements, if there's no peritonitis, there's no perforation, there's no toxic megacolon, they're in an early disease trajectory, and you had a younger patient with a better physiologic reserve.
And I'll contrast, colectomy is definitely the right answer. Obvious for any patient with evidence of perforation, or exam evidence of peritonitis. As we discussed earlier, a little more subtle, but still a good indication for colectomy would be a persistent or worsening acidosis, multi-organ dysfunction syndrome, or they still require a significant volume of fluid colectomy.
Yeah, I sometimes feel like it might be a slippery slope when talking about loop ileostomy, and it seems like there might be a risk that it could potentially delay definitive care.
Yeah, and that's the danger. If you use it in the wrong patient, you just delayed the inevitable colectomy and subsequently increased the mortality.
When you look at the ASCAR guidelines, it kind of reflects this nuance in a little bit more black and white manner. They say that subtotal colectomy remains the gold standard recommendation and that loop ileostomy is a weak recommendation with low quality evidence. And you should consider it selectively, but just don't do it routinely. I think the safe board answer when pairing is clear. It's subtotal colectomy. But in the real world, the answer is really more nuanced and somewhat gray. And I think loop ileostomy is truly going to be a tool, but it's not a replacement for source control. So with that, I think we've done a pretty good job, guys. Let's while we close out with some rapid fire questions. Desra, with fulminant C. diff, what kind of diagnosis do you use?
So it's clinical and physiologic, not just radiographic.
Right. Raymond, tell us about the best initial medical management for fulminant disease.
So it's high dose enteral vancomycin plus IV metronidazole with rectal vancomycin if there's an ileus present.
Solid. Desra, what's the gold standard operation?
Subtotal colectomy, rectal stump closure, and ileostomy creation.
Why not segmental colectomy, Raymond?
So a CDI is mucosal and diffuse, so essentially the outside of the colon can lie to you.
What about loop ileostomy?
Selective option, weak evidence, and not for the crashing patient.
And Raymond, finish us off with the biggest mistake.
Like waiting for perforation, megacolon, or irreversible organ failure. Don't do that.
Solid. All right, well, fulminant C. diff is one of the few diseases in EGS where the hardest decision is not what operation to do, it's when to stop hoping medical therapy works. The colon is the source, the physiology is the warning, and time is the enemy. The question isn't, can I save the colon? The better question should be, can I save the patient? So with that, I want to thank everyone for hanging out with us here in Tiger Country at Mizzou.
Dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple, iOS, and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.